expressed to the residents of Vancouver and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5:05 and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
Up first, we have an encore of Curious by Nature, a new segment from our science reporter, Michael Ruffalo. Drones were one of the hottest items for purchase this holiday season, and as their numbers in the sky increase, the danger to animals climb with it.
We also have Megan Devlin's interview with Natalie Clark for UBC Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Natalie Clark is a faculty member with UBC's School of Social Work. She participated in the January 20th talk, Coming Together at the Intersections, Sexualized Violence in Our Communities.
To conclude the show, we have a discussion panel with special guests Neil Janssen and Mayan Kretzman from UBC Insiders. They'll discuss the unintentionally leaked documents about former UBC President Arvind Gupta's resignation.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, leaked UBC documents reveal the administrative conflict between Arvind Gupta's resignation. Months after the initial request, UBC's Office of Information and Privacy released documents relating to former UBC President Arvind Gupta's resignation on Monday. The initial document dump was heavily redacted and contained little information about why Gupta suddenly resigned from his position last July. However, a post on Reddit revealed that the Freedom of Information release included a PDF attachment containing records that were completely free of redactions. The unedited records included email correspondence between Gupta and John Montalbano, former chair of the university's board of directors, in the days leading up to his resignation. The emails from Montalbano revealed a deterioration in the relationship between Gupta and the board. In one email, Montalbano writes, quote, "As president and leader, issues such as low employee morale on campus, the relationship challenges with your key stakeholders, and the simmering external reputational risks developing as a result of these challenges are fully yours to own." Thursday, Gupta, who until now has been silent about his resignation, told CBC Radio that he, quote, "now regrets resigning from the presidency and not pushing back harder." He added that he felt the lack of confidence shown in him by the board left him no choice but to resign.
In local news, Ernie Cray, the chief of the Chiam First Nations in BC, has spoken about the need for men and boys to be included in the government's inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women. Cray spoke to CBC's The Current about his own experience when his brother died under mysterious circumstances in 1968. He has also lost three other siblings. UBC Okanagan researchers found that men and boys account for 71% of Aboriginal homicide victims in Canada. Cray said that the report, quote, it's irrefutable. The statistics involving men and boys are really staggering. Dr. Adam Jones, a professor of political science at the UBC Okanagan, started a petition in November calling for the inquiry to be gender inclusive. The petition has 190 signatures. However, not everyone agrees that the inquiry needs to include men. Back in November, Daniel Tassile, a social activist from Yellowknife, told CBC that the root cause of male violence are better understood. He said, while he doesn't know if a separate inquiry for men or boys is necessary, the inquiry needs to address the violence and oppression that is unique to Indigenous women.
In national news, the Public Health Agency of Canada has confirmed four Canadians have now been affected with the Zika virus after traveling to affected areas. There are two cases in BC, one in Alberta, and another in the country. However, the risk of infection is low in Canada, as Aedes mosquitoes who carry the virus cannot survive the climate. Also, only 20 to 25% of people with the virus develop symptoms, including fever, headache, pink eye, rash, and joint or muscle pain. Canada's Chief Public Health Officer, Dr. Gregory Taylor, says Canadian and U.S. scientists are working on a potential vaccine for the Zika virus. According to Gary Kobinger of Laval University, the vaccine is in the clinical production. Kobinger said, quote, "We'll be able to start enrolling volunteers again with regulatory approval and start a phase one clinical trial in mid or late summer."
In national news, the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal has ruled that the federal government discriminates against First Nations children on reserves by not providing the same level of child welfare services. It found that Ottawa's funding model and management of First Nations child and family services, quote, resulted in denials of services and created various adverse impacts for many First Nations children and families living on reserves. The decision recommends an overhaul of the childhood welfare system and its funding model, as well as the consultation of First Nation experts to provide more culturally appropriate services. It also recommends increased funding and support to allow First Nations to deliver their own child welfare. Executive Director of the First Nations and Family Caring Society, Cindy Blackstock, who filed a complaint in the complaint in 2007, says the decision is a complete victory. Aboriginal lawyers believe the ruling may also set a precedent to address other inequalities facing First Nations, including education, housing, access to clean water, and health care. Mary Claude Landry, Chief Commissioner of the Human Rights Commission, wrote of the decision, quote, "This historic decision could have a profound impact on how the Government of Canada funds other on-reserve programs and services."
In international news, Canada is to lift sanctions on Iran. Foreign Affairs Minister Stéphane Dion announced Canada will be lifting sanctions on Iran in response to a deal reducing Iran's nuclear program. However, opposition conservatives have criticized the decision, advocating for continued hardline policies towards the state. Conservative foreign affairs critic Tony Clement said, quote, "The intention of the federal Liberal government to lift sanctions against Iran is 180 degrees in the wrong direction." Clement added, quote, "Now is not the time to review or remove sanctions against a country that is still not within the world family of nations that cooperates and works with other nations." Dion acknowledged that while some of the sanctions will be lifted, the Canadian government will continue to stand against Iran's human rights abuses. Dion said, quote, "We think that when we have a disagreement with the regime, we don't pull out. You work harder to be sure you'll see improvements. We need to be there to be sure this agreement will be fulfilled and implemented and respected." He also noted that while Canada will be more friendly with Iran, they will not be opening an embassy in Tehran in the immediate future.
Al Jazeera, in other news, Al Jazeera is suing Egypt for suppressive action against its journalists. Following the 2013 overthrow of President Mohamed Morsi's Muslim Brotherhood, the Egyptian government revoked the broadcaster's reporting license. They also arrested several Al Jazeera reporters and raided its offices. The broadcaster's statement says, quote, "A large number of journalists working for Al Jazeera were subjected to harassment, arrest, and detention, either without charge or on clearly spurious and politically motivated charges." The network claims the actions of Egyptian authorities have cost them over $150 million in damages. The arrest and sentencing of three Al Jazeera English journalists in 2014, including Canadian journalist Mohamed Fahmy, sparked international attention. All three were released last year. Fahmy now teaches at UBC's Graduate School of Journalism and is asking Egyptian authorities to restore his citizenship. The Egyptian government claims to have not seen the Al Jazeera report.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
My name is David Scott. I play wide receiver for the University of British Columbia football team, and I'm here to discuss the Be More Than a Bystander program. Myself and a few other players were lucky enough to work alongside the BC Lions and EVA, the Ending Violence Association, to support this cause. The main goal of the Be More Than a Bystander initiative is to increase awareness of domestic violence against women. For more information on the cause, please visit endingviolence.org.
The AIDS Vancouver Helpline is here to help. Open from 9 to 4, Monday to Friday, the Helpline answers questions about HIV and safer sex. Call to find medical support in your area without giving your name. Run by volunteers, the Helpline is one of the many programs from AIDS Vancouver combating the HIV epidemic in the Lower Mainland. While not medical professionals, our volunteers answer your questions confidentially and anonymously. The Helpline number is 604-696-4666. Or contact us at aidsvancouver.org.
Do you like laughing, hilarity, radical thought-provoking creativity, and laughing? UBC Improv is UBC's home for improvisational comedy. theater made up on the spot. Like us on Facebook to learn when our next shows are. Search for us on YouTube for our film sketches. And follow us on Twitter because we want the followers. UBC Improv. Insert cheesy slogan here. Let's get it on.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have an encore presentation of News 101 science reporter Michael Ruffalo's new segment, Curious by Nature.
So I'm online looking for a cool story to write about for this large assignment due in my journalism class. Coming from a biology background, I figured that I would keep my searches to include something science-y or something to do with animals. I happened to come across an article written by the CBC regarding a researcher at the Vancouver Aquarium. It turns out that some scientists are using drones, that's right, they're using the remote-controlled aircrafts that everyone wanted for Christmas to spy on their neighbors, to capture images of killer whales off the coast of British Columbia. Perfect. This is great.
January was sexual.
So I'm online looking for a cool story to write about for this large assignment due in my journalism class. Coming from a biology background, I figured that I would keep my searches to include something science-y or something to do with animals. I happened to come across an article written by the CBC regarding a researcher at the Vancouver Aquarium. It turns out that some scientists are using drones, that's right, they're using the remote-controlled aircrafts that everyone wanted for Christmas to spy on their neighbors, to capture images of killer whales off the coast of British Columbia. Perfect. This is great. I'll email the media team at the Vancouver Aquarium and set up an appointment. This is where things got a little interesting. After a quick exchange with the media coordinator from the aquarium, I was told that the researcher behind the study, this guy named Dr. Barrett Leonard, does not wish to be an advocate for drone technology. Right away I saw a red flag. I mean, what's the big deal? Why would this researcher not want to be known for being a pioneer in research techniques? So I do some research, and slowly I begin to sink my body down the rabbit hole. All right. The next thing I did was hop on Google to find some potential dirt on drones coming into contact with animals. Maybe there have been a few collisions. Maybe a drone killed an animal. Who knows? I just figured there had to be something on there that I could find. And I was right. The University of Minnesota released a study in August. The researchers showed that when drones were flown above the heads of bears, their heart rates skyrocketed. One mother bear, out of fear for her nearby cubs, had her heart rate spike over 400% as she panicked. With that information, and a few other press releases and studies, I felt confident going into my interview with the doctor a few days later. I pull up to the Vancouver Aquarium and sign in with a receptionist, who then leads me down this twisty hallway to the office of Dr. Barrett Leonard. He stands eye to eye as he greets me, and we shake hands. His outfit was rather casual, and his hair was both well-kept and frizzled all at once. Kind of strange, but I liked it. Anyways, we sit and exchange a few pleasantries, but really, I just jumped right into it. After a brief introduction to his research, I wanted to know how he really felt about drones being used to study whales and other animals in general. Did he feel like he was disturbing them? Could you even tell if you're disturbing them?
My gut feeling is that we're not disturbing them much. We haven't done the, you know, we haven't looked at heart rates, we haven't measured corticosteroids in, you know, fecal samples or something like that, so we don't know for sure. But I don't think we're disturbing them much, partly because we're not even getting a curiosity response, and that's just from having worked with whales for 25 years, killer whales. When they're really aware of something, they almost always check it out. So we really expected that they'd roll over and look at
just
it.
Kind of,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and the fact that they
didn't
don't
happen.
That hasn't happened at all.
Okay.
So the fact that hasn't happened gives me some reason to think that we're not disturbing them. But I'm not.
All right, that's fine. That makes sense. Being the expert that he is, Dr. Barrett Leonard believes that he can accurately tell when a whale is stressed out. The only problem with that statement is that it's a direct contradiction to something that he said earlier while answering that very same question.
discerning the behavior of an animal based on, I mean, sorry, the stress experienced by an animal based on its on what it does is fraught. You know, wild animals are pretty good at disguising a lot of things. So if you, you know, if you go out and do something, and an animal changes its behavior, you can measure it before, then you know you've changed it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fine. If you don't change, you know, if you don't pick up any behavioral distance difference, you can't really conclude that you haven't changed, you haven't disturbed it. You obviously haven't disturbed it in a way that you can detect.
And this makes sense too. Just because you don't notice a change doesn't mean that there isn't a change. This is the very reason why the researchers from Minnesota monitored the heart rate of bears. Heart rate is a more honest indicator of stress level than a behavior change. Thankfully, Dr. Barrett Leonard seemed to acknowledge this problem. He tells me that he and his team are careful not to disturb the whales as best as they can, flying drones high, over 100 feet above the orcas, doing their best to keep the machine's six spinning rotor blades quiet, and limiting the number of flights they do all go into limiting any potential harm. I wanted to know, though, why was he so concerned about being seen as a drone advocate? The term poster boy was even used. Poster boy? As if Dr. Barrett Leonard's frizzled hair is going to be printed on 8.5x11 paper and taped to lampposts? Regardless, I wondered why he was weary of this title. And his response was rather direct.
Because people like you keep on asking for interviews. Why, Michael?
A little tongue-in-cheek, sure. But his concerns are warranted. Dr. Barrett Leonard told me that he has witnessed horrible drone flying practices while working in South Africa. In order to get amazing footage, a drone operator was flying his machine just 5 feet above the ocean surface while a pod of dolphins were breaching and jumping. Thankfully, there were no collisions. But Baron Leonard is more worried about the future of drone usage in the Vancouver area, especially if technology gets into the hands of the whale-watching companies.
Whale-watching is a big industry in BC. It's quite amazing, actually, how many thousands of people go out every year to watch whales. You know, if you had a bunch of drones flying over the whales at any given time, that really changes the nature of that viewing experience for the public as well. And every whale-watching company would love to have a drone of its own. I mean, imagine, there's nothing wrong with them wanting it. You know, you can, you know, if you could take a bunch of people out, you fly a drone off the boat, you take a video, there's the boat, there are the whales, you sell it to them at the end of the trip. Kind of a good deal.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, if there are multiple drones flying over the whales, it's going to be banned. You're going to get operators, whale-watching operators complaining about each other, you're going to have mid-air collisions, it could easily get out of control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if a whale-watching association, you know, a bunch of companies got together and said, we're going to have one drone between us, we're going to fly it high, we're going to do one video a day, we're going to sell it to all of our customers. That might, you know, I can't take a position on that. That might be just absolutely fine. But I think the proliferation of drones flying over the animals would be bad for a whole bunch of reasons. And not the least of which is we still don't know, you know, if about the disturbance factor.
As I left the building with a smile on my face, I was satisfied with the answers that I was able to pull out, but I still wanted to know more. I got into contact with a local drone hobbyist by the name of Amiel de Guzman, and he told me of a strange phenomena that he encountered when he and his friend both flew their drones in close proximity to each other.
We had the same exact drone, and one of my wires, I think it exploded inside, because it didn't explode, but it just, I think there was short circuit. I was seeing his feed. He was seeing my camera feed,
okay.
So it was intertwining.
As you can imagine, this is not good. And Barrett Leonard's fears seem to be closer to reality than paranoia. After all, if just two drones in the air caused electrical interference, having dozens in the air in the hands of whale-watching companies would be disastrous. In late August of 2015, a Washington-based photographer broke the law and was charged when he flew a drone too close to a pod of orcas. We have similar laws in British Columbia. It turns out the photographer was doing all of this in order to capture film of swimming killer whales as a means of promoting his photography business. And despite being fined, the offenders still have the video posted on their YouTube channel to showcase their photography. So why does Dr. Barrett Leonard think he's exempt from backlash? Why is he allowed to continue to fly drones? Well, his research is steeped in conserving killer whale populations. the specific population that he studies, the southern residents, are critically endangered. And he looks to determine how healthy the whales are based on their body composition and which salmon populations are vitally important for the sustainability of this group of killer whales. The ultimate goal is conservation. And this may mean segregating a run of salmon so that the orcas can get a chance to feed and stay afloat. What this means for the salmon fishing industry remains uncertain, but for now, the skies above the killer whales will have a lone, buzzing follower. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. Now we have News 101 correspondent Megan Devlin and her interview with Natalie Clark on Sexual Assault Awareness Month.
Weeks. Over the past few weeks, the university organized several events called Coming Together at the Intersections, Sexualized Violence in Our Communities. Natalie Clark was one of the speakers at the panel. She's on faculty at UBC School of Social Work and also works as a trauma counselor, activist, and researcher with Indigenous girls in urban and rural spaces. I caught up with Natalie after the panel.
And in your work, you really emphasize coming together and intersectionality.
Yeah.
Why?
Well, I sometimes sort of say, I mean, intersectionality is a word, you know, coined by Kimberly Crenshaw, but for me, emerged out of, and there's lots of knowledge in Indigenous communities of holism, of interconnected, and the long legacy of Indigenous women speaking out about violence. Is it Kalasa, Winnemucca, like going back hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years to kind of call this out. So for me, it's a part of a way of saying, what are the pieces that come together? Mm-hmm. So to me, colonialism isn't separate from gender, age, who I am in this body, how violence is impacting me. So for me, it's a way to describe all of those things coming together, and that I always probably have learning in one of those places or spaces to understand how that's happening and how violence is impacting certain bodies in certain places and who's not included, what kind of violence we erase. For example, does mining in my town be considered violence that I'm experienced by, that I see as being sexualized and part of a longer piece? If that's not part of your definition, then I can't access your service or support. Mm-hmm. So how we define, I think, experiences of violence and the frameworks we use to mobilize says who accesses service and what kinds of services flow from that. So for me, coming together is a chance to kind of say who's not part of this, who are we leaving out, or what kinds of my experience do I have to leave at the door in order to access your service.
And in your work in social work in Canada, in British Columbia, who has been left out from those services?
Well, I'll speak from my contacts growing up in a small town, so rural children and youth, and gender nonconforming, queer, two-spirit. That's a lens that for me is left out, partly because service just sometimes isn't provided in those communities, or if it's provided, it's funded and provided by a Western colonial lens, meaning there might be a mental health counselor who travels out to that community a day a week, but who frames my experience through maybe mental health, a diagnostic statistic manual developed not by or for me, that frames my coping mechanism, my self-harming, my eating disorder, my addictions as a problem rather than resistance. Mm-hmm. So I think who gets left out are sometimes those without service, but I would argue sometimes that can be a benefit because the service that comes in isn't always a benefit. Mm-hmm. So I would say there's invisible violence is happening all the time and every day.
And in your work in social work in Canada, in British Columbia, who has been left out from those services?
Well, I'll speak from my contacts growing up in a small town, so rural children and youth, and gender nonconforming, queer, two-spirit. That's a lens that for me is left out, partly because service just sometimes isn't provided in those communities, or if it's provided, it's funded and provided by a Western colonial lens, meaning there might be a mental health counselor who travels out to that community a day a week, but who frames my experience through maybe mental health, a diagnostic statistic manual developed not by or for me, that frames my coping mechanism, my self-harming, my eating disorder, my addictions as a problem rather than resistance. Mm-hmm. So I think who gets left out are sometimes those without service, but I would argue sometimes that can be a benefit because the service that comes in isn't always a benefit. Mm-hmm. So I would say there's invisible violence is happening all the time and every day here on this campus. Mm-hmm.
And the work that you do, like working, like I guess, like you said, as a counselor for like victims of sexual violence, especially in Indigenous communities, how do you do it?
And for me, the act of witnessing, of supporting, receive it, I get to be witness to amazing survivance, to especially in my work with children and youth who've experienced violence and are experiencing violence, to their strengths, their coping, their resistance. And yes, the stories are something to honor, but I feel like that piece that I do a day a week, or if I'm running a group in community, is what keeps me alive in this work.
I know this is a large question, but is there something we can do to, I guess, reduce sexualized violence?
I guess when I think of what we can do is to work at in the intimate sphere of our relationships and to make sure we're talking about and considering issues of consent, of naming violence in all its forms, looking at the roots of sexualized violence on this land and in this space, and having those conversations with my children, with family, with others.
Natalie used her poetry to evoke emotion at the panel.
My body has melted, ice cracking from oppression, revealing bone and sinew. My language is screaming inside my flesh, buried under your schools, your words, your wounds left me here. Emerging, I drape myself in orange, I tattoo freedom on my body, I pierce remembering on my face. You will never enter me again. I have marked my territory this time. You are not welcome. Oppression melted reveals stone, sinew, bone. Soul syrup on my tongue. I know my map, my body. Do you? I wrote that poem shortly after I left the small town I grew up and moved to the city of Vancouver to come study at UBC. It speaks to me, to the legacy of colonization, the absence of consent, and the violations of land and body, but also names and evokes the power of resistance and survivance in the face of abuse, violence, and the absence of consent. I've never published that poem. It's not part of the writing I do, but I think that the kinds of art and spaces we make to tell our truth are important.
That was UBC's Natalie Clark speaking about her work with sexualized violence in Indigenous girls. For more stories on UBC's Sexual Assault Awareness Month, check out podcasts by News 101 and Lady Radio at citr.ca. I'm Megan Devlin for News 101, Vancouver.
Thank you, Megan. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Thousands of opinions are at our fingertips, but are all opinions informed? Does your information have a source? Is your social feed based on fact? Only facts can uncover the truth. Professional journalists are committed to balanced and nonpartisan reporting, to independent commentary. They cut through the spin to give you the information and perspective you need. Journalism is essential to democracy. A watchdog over the powerful, an independent voice. Journalism is more important than ever.
Give it up Wednesdays 3 to 4.
I mean, I just wanted to do a nice experimental music radio show and maybe throw in some feeling nice you're talking that anonymous. Private body sense in your podcast. I mean, I think I can talk, and that's good enough.
Fight or flight music sometimes for things that are not all right.
I just
radio essays and travesties, radio catechisms, half-baked philosophy and criticism, experimental beat music, avant-garde, post-punk, industrial, noise, ad nauseum. Cue it up.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
How much do you know about bikes? Everything? Perfect. Nothing at all? Even better. At the UBC Bike Kitchen, you can use our space and tools to do your own bike maintenance. Get one-on-one instruction on how to fix your bike yourself, or drop your bike off for us to repair. You can also buy a fully refurbished, guaranteed used bicycle, or a variety of new and used parts and accessories. The Bike Kitchen is UBC's non-profit, student-owned, full-service bike shop. We're located in the basement of the Student Union Building. Just look for the stairwell on the north side of the sub across from Gage Towers, or search for the UBC Bike Kitchen on Facebook. Stop by the Bike Kitchen and then get riding.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca. Broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have two special guests joining us in the studio. Neil Janssen and Mayan Kreitzman are the hosts of UBC Insiders, a program which analyzes the governance of UBC's Point Grey campus. News 101 co-director Rohit Joseph will moderate a discussion on the recent Freedom of Information dump regarding former UBC president Arvind Gupta's resignation.
Thank you, Eva. So first things first, welcome to Neil. Mayan will be joining us shortly. But Neil, let's put things into context for our listeners here on News 101. We'll start with the documents that UBC had released intentionally to begin the week. And can you put things into context regarding what was the information that we actually found out from the Freedom of Information requested documents?
Sure. So what had happened is after President Gupta had resigned last August, there were, I think, dozens of Freedom of Information requests that were filed to the university. And so rather than doing them each of them individually, I think they decided to make one complete package to respond to all of them at once. And so that's what came out on Monday of this week. And it was, I think, 861 pages of records, of emails, of documents, of letters, and things like that.
That's a lot of documents.
It is. And so it took a while to really sort through them. And I really haven't had a chance to go through them all in depth at this point. And so in there, there's a lot of things about expenses of Dr. Gupta. And so maybe there's something in there that no one's found yet. It'd have to be analyzed pretty closely. There's a lot of emails and a lot of correspondence with the Ministry of Advanced Education as well. And so there wasn't anything necessarily that people learned immediately from that, especially because so much of the information was redacted and hidden. And so, you could get hints of things. Certainly you could draw inferences, but there is no, I guess, smoking gun in that package.
Mm-hmm. And regarding the whole redaction, for Freedom of Information requested documents, was it totally legal for UBC to actually redact that much, or was that a questionable thing that they did there?
Well, it's absolutely within the structure of the law that you don't just release everything completely openly.
Mm-hmm.
Without knowing what exactly was redacted, it's hard to know that it was done properly or legally. They do have trained professionals in the University Office of the Legal Counsel that is doing this, so presumably they take their job seriously and are doing it in accordance with the law. But, you know, it's hard to know. But it definitely is a regular and necessary feature of the law that you can withhold some details.
Fair enough.
And I should point out something like, you know, if you sent an email with your personal phone number to someone at UBC, you wouldn't necessarily want that released. So
that's fair,
the type
yeah.
of thing that would be withheld.
Okay. Now, take me back to the moment that you and Mayan found the leaked documents. Where were you at that moment?
Oh, I was just at home. It was about 11 o'clock on Tuesday night. My wife had just gone to bed, so I went back outside into our living room and was browsing Reddit, as one does in the evening.
Fair enough. Yeah.
And I noticed that some poster had put up links to unredacted documents on the UBC subreddit, and that people hadn't really seemed to get on this story yet.
There were no upvotes.
Well, there were a few.
Oh, okay.
There were a few, and it was actually a couple hours old at that time.
Yeah.
But the site that hosted the documents had a count of how many people had read it, and it was only about a dozen at that point. So,
wow.
So I knew that this was something that I could, get out if I acted really quickly.
And you went right to it.
Yeah.
So take us through those stages of, you finding it.
Yeah. So it was all right there. At first, I wasn't sure whether it was real or not, just someone anonymously posting this online. It's hard to know. But once I figured out how to check for attachments and figured out that's where they were, it became clear that these were very real, and I just messaged my aunt with a message that is profane. It was holy F, basically. And then we got to work on it.
We say that on the air. Are we not allowed to when it's live?
Unfortunately, we're still at that watershed hour thing. So,
okay.
The kids are out right now, so you're going to have to bleep it for now. Well, welcome, Maya. Thank you for joining us.
Yeah, sorry, I was a bit late.
Yeah, no problem, but perfect timing. So Neil was just describing on the moment he found the documents and sent you a message.
Yeah.
What were your thoughts right then and there?
Just opened them up, started reading, and basically all of the stuff is quotable. It's quite...
Yeah, that was actually my big problem, is how do we pick quotes? It's all, you should just read the whole six pages.
Yeah, so we ended up writing it up with a few sort of block quotes and then just having a bunch of points at the end so people could read the rest of it if they didn't want to download everything, which they could because it was all right there, already saved on hundreds of hard drives of people that had downloaded the FOI package. Just a lucky break, really.
Yeah, and so you'd found it on Reddit, and like you had mentioned, it's somebody anonymously posting it. Did you try to contact that person?
Oh, I did, yeah. The first thing I did is message them, and basically I was trying to determine how to figure out whether it was they were genuine or not. Mm-hmm. So I messaged this person saying, how did you get these? Are these real? That person did actually eventually respond. I still have no idea who it is. They just, had a nice note about the piece we ultimately wrote, but didn't want to reveal who they were.
Yeah, and our initial reaction was, this must be someone disgruntled employee. But it doesn't seem like that at all. It's just somebody that realized that these were attached and that you could access them. Hmm. I don't think too many people realize that you can attach documents to PDF files. Apparently you can.
Wow. And so you couldn't get a sense of the motivation then? It didn't seem obvious?
Oh, I think it was a total accident, yeah.
Total accident.
Like a terrible mistake, certainly on UBC's part, but I don't think there was any intent to do that, especially given what has come out of that afterwards. And also what I've been saying is that I went back and checked some of the ones that were released to me as well in the past, because I file a lot of these FOI requests, and some of them actually have had attachments in the same way. They were mishandled in the same way. But I think... in those, I never would have noticed. I think this is partly a function of the fact that hundreds of people were looking at this thing and had downloaded this thing, that it just takes one to figure this out. And normally you wouldn't have hundreds of eyes on a typical, much less high-profile FOI release.
So you write your headline. You write...
That was last thing.
Yeah. I was just going to say, though, how did it feel to break this story?
Yeah, it was exciting. I mean, at 3 a.m. when we published it, we were tired, but Neil sent me a message saying something like, let's go to bed, we'll promote in the morning. And I was just thinking, we won't need to promote this. This is going to be on fire on Twitter. And it was as soon as we woke up. The people on the Eastern Seaboard had already picked it up and a couple of reporters and stuff.
Yeah, and I had sent some emails to people I knew who would be very interested to read this that they should check first thing in the morning. And so I think they did.
So what was the biggest surprise you found about the leaked documents?
I don't know. I think it's just how direct they are. I don't think it's news to anyone that President Gupta's leadership style was grating on people. I certainly got that same impression when he was around as well. But, man, John is ruthless.
Yeah, they're so direct and so... I mean, it's weird because on the one hand, it's six pages of complaints, so there's a lot of detail in there. On the other hand, they're vague in the sense that it's kind of everything. It's just fundamental stuff about every aspect of his leadership. And so it's stuff that's really hard to address in a kind of detailed way. So there's kind of two sides to that. There's so many that in a way it's hard to come back and say, okay, I'm going to improve on this, this, and this.
Yeah, and if the goal was really to try to improve Gupta's demeanor or behavior, it didn't strike me as being particularly constructive criticism. It was just criticism.
Hmm. And what did this reveal about kind of like the way that the Board of Governors operates? Because a lot of us are unfamiliar with this whole system of government at UBC. So what did you guys find out about the operation of the Board of Governors?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's an important point, Rohit. There's the whole realm of the content of the criticism and issues around Gupta's vision and his leadership of the university, his pathway that people might have had legitimate concerns with. And then there's all of the issues with how the board went about critiquing him and evaluating him and ultimately causing his resignation.
Yeah, and to be clear, it is the board's legislated role in the University Act, a provincial law. It is their role to oversee and supervise the performance of the president. That is their role, and it was written into his contract that he was supposed to have a performance review.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just that the performance review should have happened through the correct committee of the board, with everyone involved, not an ad hoc committee that was convened to do it in this
Which
way.
Brings
it
me
it
to,
wasn't even a yeah. committee, right? It was just this informal grouping of a number of the members of the executive mm-hmm. of the board. And when we talked to former President Gupta yesterday on the phone, he basically said that he doesn't think or he's not sure how many other board members were even aware of this sub-committee cabal grouping. And that he's not sure that certainly the entire board or even, you know, whatever committee was supposed to deal with his evaluation knew about it until late July when they wanted to convene a slightly more formal subcommittee. And that's what precipitated his departure.
Yeah, so Gupta did respond throughout the week. He had actually officially ended his non-disclosure agreement. What is the deal with that, actually? You mentioned that you talked to him yesterday, so is he fully aware that, yes, I have ended this non-disclosure agreement, or is there some way that that's still intact?
Well, no, that's in shreds now. And
that's
in theory, I think the university could probably withhold payment of whatever salary he's owed under that, but mm-hmm. you know,
they're
given
the
that
ones
this
that
is
broke it first,
yeah,
right?
Given that this is a PR nightmare for them, how terrible for PR would it be for them to then take that action, right?
Yeah, and Gupta has now responded with saying that, like, yeah, he didn't get the chance to have a performance review, but in his response, he hasn't been super like defiant as you would expect him to be. And you guys had actually mentioned this on your podcast just yesterday, and I wanted to get your thoughts as to what might be the reason for that.
Do you mean in his written response in those May letters?
I mean kind of like generally speaking, but I heard his CBC interview.
Well, I think everything you have to look at yesterday through the lens that he very quickly hired a PR firm to work with him, and he was quite a bit on message. I listened to or read at least 6 interviews with him yesterday in addition to the one that we did. And, you know, the same themes come up again because he's been given a message by a PR firm and he was definitely staying on it.
That's probably the lowest risk, I guess.
And I'm sure, you know, one of the things they told him not to do was to, you know, be too overtly antagonistic.
Mm-hmm. So, the UBC Faculty Association is calling for an investigation into the board. How effective would an investigation be at this point in time? What can we learn from it?
Well, that's one of the problems. I mean, I think an investigation is a great idea, and everyone's been calling for reform of the Board of Governors, and you have to have some sort of process where you find out what's wrong in an official capacity and then go about fixing it. But that pends the cooperation of people on the board. If you're going to investigate this incident, for example, people need to open up and speak about it. And Neil, I know you were concerned that if they started an investigation, it'll just be a way to create a sort of positive spin on things and still not necessarily do anything.
Yeah, my position is if you have no problem creating secret ad hoc committees and lying to everyone about it, then how could we possibly believe that members of the board would be participating in any sort of review in good faith?
Mm-hmm.
That they're not just, you know, straight up lying to us some more about what they did or didn't do.
That continues, right? Neil went around to a couple offices to try to just get some details about meeting times and dates for the committees that are happening for the board next week.
Any luck?
No, not really. They're saying that the governance committee of the board, for example, doesn't have a meeting next week, which is fine, but I honestly wonder whether we're going to find out whether they actually do.
And it's shocking because one of the things I was thinking about after interviewing Gupta and after Neil, you mentioned that that you had asked the president's office which committee meetings were happening, and they said, we don't know, we only know what's posted on the website, and these things aren't posted on the website. Gupta also mentioned to us that as president, the president is a member of every single committee of the board, and he would not be informed about committee meetings. So, like, if the president of UBC is being sidelined and ignored and not being informed of committee meetings, what hope do the rest of us have? And I'm quite curious, because Martha is considerably less clueless than he would have been if she truly doesn't know that when and these committee meetings are happening, or if she's also not being invited, which would be shocking as well.
Mm-hmm. So, throughout this whole debacle, really, there's been this issue of Gupta being a professor first. Like, he was a professor before he became a president. So to what extent did being a professor kind of set him up to be an outsider when he became president?
I don't know. And he wasn't really a professor for many of the years leading up to the presidency.
Okay.
He was mostly managing an organization called MyTax.
Yes, that's true.
And which is really not core to his faculty duties.
Yeah, but that was what I think that was his main qualification for the presidency, his creation and leadership of MyTax, which is this organization that connects between academics and industry groups, and ended up getting a big chunk of funding from the federal government. So that was one of his, that's sort of what set him up as being this leader for the 21st century that could take the university in a new direction. But I don't know how that set him up.
As an outsider?
No. I mean, he was from UBC, so in that sense, he was more of an insider and would have known more people here than a typical candidate. But that comes with baggage as well, perhaps. He certainly has a group of, you know, quite vocal supporters.
And most of them seem to be from the faculty, from my understanding at least. A lot of supporters, right?
Yeah, and certainly in the wake of the resignation, a lot of people were trying to point to his lack of administrative experience as being a drawback.
Yeah, he said he wasn't a career administrator.
I don't think that's necessarily fair, because he was an administrator basically at MyTax as well. It's just a different thing. I don't necessarily know that he's more of an insider or an outsider than anyone else. He's certainly more of an outsider than someone who, you know, was a faculty dean for 8 years, then became a vice president for another 7 years, then became president. That's just more of a straightforward succession to the top. But at the same time, the previous president, Stephen Toop, wasn't really a professor anymore. He actually came from the Pierre Trudeau Institute. He had previously been a dean, but before he was hired, he was in some completely external, separate organization.
Okay. So it's not the first time that we've had somebody who could be considered an outsider in terms of administrative role?
No, absolutely not.
All right. Now I get to the kind of touchy subject of Gupta being, the first person of color to actually be a president at UBC. So with that kind of thinking in mind, this goes back to the Jennifer Berdahl's blog post where she said Gupta lost a masculinity contest and also mentioned his race being a potential factor as, you know, she, of course, this was her speculating at the time, just thinking of reasons why the Board of Governors may not have appreciated him or took a liking to him. Now that you guys have kind of gone through some of these leaked documents, do you think there's any water held by, you know, Berdahl's blog post back in the summer?
Well, I think refer first to the woman herself. Jennifer Berdahl was actually on CBC Radio yesterday discussing that. So I definitely can't pretend to be any more of an expert than she did. And we also asked Gupta that question himself.
Yeah.
Yeah, we did ask him that. He basically said when you're in a situation, when you're so close to a situation, you're not the expert that can analyze the situation. So he sort of sidestepped it a bit. He said that he was given enormous opportunities at UBC and that he didn't feel any overt racism directed towards him. Obviously, he was given the opportunity to lead UBC. But the thing that Jennifer Berdahl points out and that research shows is that these prejudices are quite insidious, and they're not necessarily somebody overtly being I don't like this guy because he's brown, but but the default ways that we respond to people can be conditioned by their gender and their race, and that people with various leadership characteristics experience penalties for those disproportionately when they come from those groups. And so I think it's going to be a question that we have to continue to ask. And I don't think that you can look at this with a sort of colorblind lens. I think that would be a mistake.
All right, guys, last question. Thank you again for taking the time to do this. My last question is more like, I guess, for an advice for fellow, you know, journalists or reporters, because you two were pretty persistent when it came to following this story, and despite, you know, UBC's reluctance to share information. What advice do you have to people who are, you know, also in a similar situation where they're trying to get information and they're constantly getting rejected? How did you guys keep up your patience and manage to persist?
I mean, but literally, this was such a lucky break.
It was lucky.
It was such a lucky thing, and you know, we were about to write up a much smaller story just on a couple interesting points that we could have scraped together from that big FOI dump, the most interesting parts of which were missing. You know, we would have pulled out a few interesting tidbits, no doubt, but. I guess read a lot of documents.
Yeah, I mean,
as boring as that sounds, it's
well, it is. I mean, I've put in thousands and thousands of hours into UBC Insider since I was a grad student, and you know, I don't have that much. It's not like I've ever really been paid for it. There's been some money that's come in once in a while, but it's just something that I do because I guess I can't help myself.
And so you have to have a little bit of an unhealthy obsession.
Yeah, and I like to read all those documents. Like Mayan said, I love to talk to people to put those documents in context. And, you know, like the more widely you read and the more people you talk to, you can start making connections. So I certainly found a lot of interesting stories that don't rise to this level of prominence, but that I find equally scandalous that UBC is doing. They don't get the same traction, but those kind of come about by just reading and paying attention and knowing history and knowing everything that's going on everywhere else. And so it's not like it's easy to do. It just, like, lots of things, it takes hard work. And
you basically have to become a bit of an expert and be relentless in your reading and just in accumulating the longer view. You know, a lot of what goes on at UBC, especially around development and so on. And I assume it's the same for other big institutions and other political, you know, scenes. Yeah. You know, there's an accumulation of history that people forget very quickly, especially when there's turnover. And I think the best stories come when you can contrast things.
And the last thing I want to add is obviously I'm known as an outspoken critic of the university, but I think I've actually mellowed quite a bit over the years, and I used to be a lot more against a lot of what they're doing. And now I feel like I'm a lot more measured, but it just means that when I do find things to criticize, I'm more secure and you know, I guess, yeah, a little bit more secure in the position I hold.
All right. Well, Thank you so much, Neil.
And just by the way, this comes from a place of love, right? Like all this criticism, it's not.
Yeah, I want UBC to be better.
Yeah, it's
That's
not
a fair point.
Us being ornery or, you know, wanting bad things to happen. This is all supposed to shine a light so that things can get better.
That's fair, and you guys have definitely put in the time to become. I guess this is the very, very last question. Would you ever actually want to be in these administrative roles to try and make the university better from the inside?
Oh yeah, UBC should totally hire me.
Biggest sellout of the century.
Well, who knows if we'll see that happen and come to fold. Thank you again so much. That was UBC Insiders Neil Janssen and Mayan Kreitzman. Thank you so much again for joining us.
Our pleasure.
Yes, thank you, Neil, Mayan, and Rohit. That's our program for January 29th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news-101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud page. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Eva.
And I'm Brent. Good night.